This is Rich Meyer with the Upper Peninsula Bigfoot Sasquatch Research Organization, and you're listening to Out There.
Frank Ricchino joins me from Florida, where it's absolutely freezing. Frank, it's about 80 degrees here. Did you know that?
In your heated house, right?
If I turn it up real high. But I'm in Michigan, and it's cold, and you're in Florida, where it's really... Of course, you get hurricanes, and I don't. When was the last hurricane that you had there, Frank?
Year before last.
That was pretty nasty, wasn't it?
Yeah, but the one before that was even worse.
That's right. You told me about all that.
In fact, Phil and I were on a show right about the time it was hitting a couple years ago.
Oh, yeah. On this show, you're saying, or a different show?
No, your show.
So I'm a bad omen. Is what it is, right?
No, actually, we were kind of lucky to get the show went under the gun, because after we finished up, I was running around outside like a nut, taking all sharp objects out of the ground and moving stuff around.
Right.
So today we have nice, clear weather. We just got over some 24-hour straight rain 2 days ago, so everything's drying up. It's about 70 degrees now.
Yeah, that's too bad. Sorry to hear that. So, Frank, how long have I known you? It's been a few years at least, right?
Yeah, yes, sir. Quite a few years, TJ. We've done quite a few shows.
And, you know, when I first heard about the story about the Flatwoods Monster, I was like, what? Come on, that never happened. Because I would have heard about it. Here I think I'm this big UFO investigator, which I'm not, by the way. But I take an interest in all these things. And so for this story to go untold... It's just amazing because people know about, you know, Roswell and some of the other incidents, but they always kind of gloss over the Flatwoods Monster. And if they do approach it, you've been on the History Channel. How do they treat you on Monster Quest?
Well, it was a lot different outcome from what I was told and led to believe, because I did about like a 5-day shoot.
Yeah.
Maybe 60 hours, 70 hours. We were going around the clock. I was kind of disappointed because they didn't even show the Flatwoods Monster. They concentrated more on this Natowski story the following night. And there was actually mock-ups of the Flatwoods Monster spacesuit done ahead of time for the show, and they just cut it and deleted it all out. They changed the script, and they never showed the monster.
No. And then we see now that, you know, what got me thinking about you was that I was found out that Project Blue Book, the TV show, which we know is not going to be accurate 100%. It's going to be a TV show. You would hope in that, they would bring a little bit of the truth in. And so they were going to do a show about the Flatwoods Monster. And you and I both saw the show. And what did you think?
Well, when I heard about it, I was excited at first. I'm like, well, it's about time that they do a show about the Flatwoods Monster, because the History Channel didn't do anything with Monster Quest, so it's about time they did something. But what I couldn't believe is nobody contacted me about it. And since I've been the authority on this case since 1991 and written a couple books about it, I probably know more than anybody on planet Earth in this story. I found it kind of odd, but on the other hand, I was kind of glad. It's like, finally, they're going to do this thing right. Wrong. Yeah. Dramatization. As far as I'm concerned, from my point of view, it was terrible.
You know,
very disappointing, and I actually feel bad for the witnesses in Flatwoods who are still alive, and for the locals who have been behind the story and supported me over the years, because I didn't like it whatsoever, and I don't even want to go into it too much more.
Right.
But I'm disappointed.
Well, I came to realize it's kind of like an X-Files show, but the one thing I did like, at the very end of the show, they did post information that people could go look up for themselves. So if it brought any kind of awareness, and they did post the real witnesses. Mrs. May was one of them. I think her picture was up there, right?
Right, and the group of kids, that photograph was actually taken by Ailey Stewart Jr., the co-owner of the Braxton Democrat. But, 30 seconds at the end doesn't do the
job. Well, that's the question I was going to ask you before we get into the story of the Flatwoods Monster. why do you think they'll cover Roswell? And I mean, they've covered that from one end to another. You have ancient aliens, that covers all these things. You even have a thing called Hangar One, which I saw not too long ago on History Channel, which was talking about the presidents and from MUFON information, all the ones that were connected to aliens and maybe, you know, met with them at some point. So many things are coming out right now. But for some reason, what is the reason they don't want the Flatwoods to come out?
Maybe because what we've talked about on earlier shows, that the public would go into an absolute shock if they found out 9-foot-tall reptilian snakes were roaming around Earth, as was the case in the Night of the Flatwoods incident in 1952.
You know, I think that too, but I mean, we've had some strange creatures, but do you think, because this is what I was thinking about, do you think maybe the fact that there was a so-called war, if the people found out about that, would that freak them out? Maybe that's why they're keeping this away from us.
The confrontation that night.
Even though it wasn't a war, you and I both talked about that, they were just defending themselves. And as we heard on Phil DeLong's interview, if you're to believe what he channeled, they were not doing that neither.
Right. The UFOs were attacked that night. That's what I've come to my conclusion. And those intelligently controlled objects flew in over the mainland, mid-Atlantic part of the United States and fanned into different directions. And I think I've said this before, Major Donald Keough, United States Marine Corps retired, he was one of the pioneers in UFO research, and he started coming to the conclusion years ago. Now, this was in the late 40s, early 50s, and he would have his map of the United States, and he was plotting points where all these different UFOs were seen over military installations, such as Air Force bases, different facilities for atomic bomb development, you know, all key strategic areas that were security sensitive. And I don't think by any means it was a coincidence when those three objects came in about 7 o'clock that night that they split and fanned into three different directions. One UFO flew southwest and it penetrated the no-fly zone through Oak Ridge National Laboratory area by 70 miles. The second UFO came in over the United States and it made a beeline. It went over Baltimore and it headed straight towards Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. A few minutes later, the third UFO came in damaged and fire pieces falling off of it. It was flying over Washington, certain parts of the Capitol. It was at treetop level. And it flew over Washington, flew about 200 miles west, made a 45-degree angle turn, followed State Route 4, and landed in Flatwoods. The reason, working with the different people I have in the background over the years, what we came to the conclusion is the reason that the Flatwoods was a predetermined area. Let me say that, TJ, it definitely was. Because where it landed was void of any nearby military bases. And if you look at a map, especially my master map, which is on my website, flatwoodsmonster.com, you could look and you could see there's no nearby bases. So there was no threat against this object when it went down in distress and it landed on Fisher Hilltop. But the UFOs have been watching us for years, TJ.
Right.
They've been watching us for years. It was not a coincidence. These things knew where everything was. When they went down that night, the damaged ones were making repeated landings. There was actually a fourth UFO that came up from the southern part of the United States, and it actually flew and went directly over to Bailey Fisher Farm, the same area where the Flatwoods Monster craft came in a few minutes later. And my military boys that I worked with were amazed looking at the scenario, and they kept saying to me, they think like us. This is a military strategy. The two most damaged crafts that night, TJ, came up from the direction of Florida. The second one flew over Washington, and they both actually flew over that Bailey Fisher farm top, which is about It's smaller than a football field. What are the chances two damaged craft, one coming from the mid-Atlantic, the other one coming up from the Gulf of Mexico area, are going to go over the same farm that's the size of a football field? They were planning this ahead of time. These were intelligently controlled craft. They were planning to put the two damaged ones in the same area where they could be picked up and escorted or escorted out of the area. And what happened is the one that came up from the southern direction, I actually was able to track it by using the Project Blue Book documents, TJ. And there was so much information. It may sound kind of funny or absurd, but there was so much information in Project Blue Book about these UFOs, I was pulling my hair out. Didn't have to fill in the blanks and try and figure out. It was just a matter of going through these documents for several years, dissecting, deciphering them, pulling the information out, figuring out the timestamps, the flight path trajectories, and then what the heck was going on during this whole time. And I actually worked with somebody who actually helped solve the whole timeline and the storyline of what occurred. I don't claim to have solved this whole thing by myself. I work with a lot of military people in the background. I pulled all the data and information out, put it on my master map, and I used a lot of other smaller maps as well when I was into regional areas. But when everything was transferred to that big map, that's when it was all figured out. And somebody assisted me very heavily with it. And that's when we ran from there and we put together a storyline of events and we recreated what happened that night. Actually, Flatwoods was the end of the story, TJ. What nobody else had done before is get the Blue Book documents out and follow what happened. There were so many UFO sightings that night, TJ, it was unbelievable. It happened over a 24-hour period, but the main part of the story all happened within an hour to an hour and a half, about 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Now, the United States was in different time zones back then as far as standard and daylight savings time, so that was a big pain in the butt to try and figure out what was going on. But when we pulled out of this whole thing, we were able to establish that these four different UFOs that were damaged, I was able to plot 13 locations where they crashed. And what they were doing, TJ, is making repeated landings. These things were damaged. And if you look at the master map, you'll be able to trace these objects, how they came into the United States and how they left the United States. Now, Frank, the only craft that I do not have an extended timeline for is the Flatwoods Monster craft.
Frank, you said that there's four, at least that you picked up. Could there have been several more?
I don't know, TJ. I was pretty thorough with my information. Okay.
So just on that night, you feel like there were four of them?
Four, right. Three came over the mid-Atlantic and fanned into three different directions, and one came up from the south, from the direction of where that missing F-94 Starfire vanished. And there was another weird incident that happened that day when the pilots disappeared and the airmen. The Flatwoods incident, the crap hit the fan approximately 45 minutes later. So it's basically connecting the dots and putting everything together.
And you got this information, your sources, like you said, Blue Book, eyewitnesses, military, were those the main sources that you got all that from?
Yes. Project Blue Book was the gold mine of information. And then what I did from there, TJ, because there was other states where UFOs were not reported. The only records that Blue Book will have as far as the eyewitnesses is if you had seen something and you contacted the Air Force, they would send you a tentative observer's questionnaire and you would fill this out and send it back to the Air Force. There was a lot of other documentation in Project Blue Book for the September 12th events, as well as the 13th, but they actually kept track of publications, newspaper articles, like the New York Post, one of the headlines in there about the monster. So they were gathering information up and who had written. There was information in there about Gray Barker and Ivan Sanderson and other people who had actually investigated this case. So they were keeping a close watch on everything that was going on subsequent to the event, just keeping an eye and a tab on stuff. I used a lot of different newspaper articles. I actually was at a point a few years ago where I thought my book was finished. This is my 2012 book when I came back after the original one in 04 was messed up by the publisher. And I thought I was ready, and I got a package in the mail from Stanton Friedman, and he was able to access and get me more UFO articles from, I believe it was the Greenwood collection. And I had to go back to the drawing board, and I had to extract all the information out of these newspaper articles. Blue Book didn't report everything. So what I'm actually doing is taking this big master map, and I'm plotting the points, times, directional headings, locations, the whole ball of wax. And these articles help to solidify my timelines and storylines. But as far as Blue Book, there was a lot of other intelligence reports that were in there, and they were actually hard to understand. So I had to get some military people in on this whole thing to kind of, you know, the jargon and the way that the documents were written.
Right.
I didn't understand. So I had to have military guys come in and sit down with me, explain what everything meant. I was doing a chunk of this before the internet, TJ. So it's not like I could just Google and like, what does this mean?
Right.
You know, or what does this acronym mean for, and this Air Force intelligence document. So I had to go right directly to the sources and try and find people willing to work with me. I worked with air traffic controllers. It was unbelievable. I worked with one air traffic controller guy, and he was actually in Vietnam, and he was amazed and thought I was kidding him when I started reading some of the different pieces and excerpts from the Air Force's aircraft accident reports for the Jones and Del Curto case. He's like, that doesn't happen. He says, even in war, this doesn't happen. And that's a whole other story we can get into later, TJ. But I work with the best available people that were willing to work with me, and Stanton Friedman is the primary person. I was trying to get Harry Truman's telephone memorandum for the 12th and 13th of September, 52, to find out what was going on and where was Truman and what phone calls were going in and out of the White House. And I told Stanton about it. I don't know, it was about a week and a half later, I get the telephone memorandum copy in the mail. Stanton found it, and he had some connections, and he got it for me, and I was able to figure out what Truman was doing at that time. He wasn't in the White House. He wasn't in his office. He was taken out, and they were receiving calls through agents. And I go into that into the book a little bit, and I actually have copies of the telephone memorandum. But I was pretty thorough all the way around, and I'm still getting information, TJ. After I do different radio shows, people are emailing me, or they call Stanton Friedman, and they put me in touch with them. And they'll give me points of their interviews of what happened, you know, when they were kids or they saw this, that, or the other over those 10 different states where UFOs were seen up and down the eastern seaboard.
So this was a big event, probably one of the biggest events. I mean, there's been many events that have happened. You know, Roswell, what is your take on Roswell, just you personally? What do you think that there was a crash disk?
I believe so, from what I've read and talked to Stanton Friedman and read his works. But the big difference between Roswell, you were in the desert in an unpopulated area where this happened on the night of September 12, 52. You're talking about major cities.
Right.
Baltimore, you know, different parts of Virginia, Washington, even the Charleston area in West Virginia, where one of the crafts redirected and crashed a few times through Charleston. You know, people say, oh, West Virginia, the mountains and hillbillies, but there were major cities throughout West Virginia as well, coming all the way down into the South. These UFOs were making blatant flyovers throughout city areas as well. And what was amazing, when I was starting to formulate this thing years ago, Stanton Friedman was reading my manuscript, and we were talking and sending notes back and forth through the mail, and he was amazed how the UFOs were following the flight corridors of the airports when they were flying throughout the United States. And then they were, these UFOs, when they got into mountainous terrains, they were following highways, like the one that flew over Flatwoods and came into Braxton County from Burnsville. That actually followed State Route 4. And these UFOs were following rivers, cutting through the valleys and following over rivers in Stanton. I remember him saying, Frank, that's what we do during wartime in World War II, that if a plane was lost, follow the river. Don't crash into a mountain, follow the river. What the UFOs were doing is following the rivers throughout the different parts of Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio, and to avoid confrontations, crashes. They were staying clear of Air Force bases, yet they were following the beacons from airport to airport, following the flight lines. Up in Wheeling, the second UFO that had crashed over Baltimore had a near collision over the Wheeling, Ohio County Airport up in the Panhandle area. When it redirected and moved down south, it almost hit a passenger plane. And there was a couple other near collisions up in that area. That was a damaged UFO. And what it did is, after it departed out of the Wheeling area, it flew down into West Virginia, into the Charleston area, and it actually, when you see its flight path, it was following the flight path of planes. So there was a lot going on and a lot covered up that night, and nobody's going to tell me the air traffic controllers back then didn't know what the hell was going on with UFOs following their flight corridors. And when that damaged one got into the Charleston area, it made several crashes. And it was seen by, these objects were seen by hundreds, maybe thousands of people that night. That's why it was so confusing, because the Air Force's official explanation, TJ, was a fireball meteor that was seen for about 5 to 6 seconds that night. And you have sightings of UFOs. I have 116 locations of 25 different objects over 10 states where all these UFOs were sighted, and the official explanation was a meteor that flew over Washington and proceeded 200 miles west and landed in Flatwoods. Well, nothing ever landed in Flatwoods as far as a meteor, because as Stanton has said over the years, jokingly, it would have been called Flattened Woods.
Right.
If a meteor that size had hit Flatwoods, Flatwoods probably wouldn't be there anymore.
Well, how could a meteor travel that? Why would it take that long to get, you know, that would be over in a matter of seconds.
It actually took about a half an hour. Once the damaged craft passed over D.C., it took about 30 minutes of it flying west before it finally hit Upper Braxton County, turned south, and then went over to school playground, redirected a 45-degree angle, went across the street and landed. So that wasn't a meteor that did that. And it took about a half an hour, TJ.
It doesn't take a meteor a half hour to travel through like that.
Done in under 10 seconds.
Yeah, it would be over just like that. And then again, I have never seen a meteor that takes a, was it a right turn? Is that what you said? It took a right turn?
45-degree angle turns.
Yeah, so it's like, well, must have hit something. That meteor must have bounced off something. Maybe it hit a plane. So
and under, like around a 5,000-foot mark, that's where radar could not pick up anything flying at low level. So I believe these UFOs knew if they flew under low level, under that 5,000-foot mark, our radar couldn't pick them up. And something else, as far as this being a supposed meteor, TJ, there was no sonic booms noted. There should have been a sonic boom for something flying in that low under 5,000 feet.
And if there was a meteor, Frank, there would have been a big fire. There was no fire in Flatwoods, right?
There was no fire. There probably wouldn't have been a small fire if it was a small meteor, which would have been a small impact pit. As far as a bigger one, yes, there should have been something else going on. Flatwoods wouldn't even been there. This thing was described as being about 30 to 40 feet long. If that thing had come in as fast as they said it was going, Flatwoods wouldn't be there anymore. It'd just be a big hole in the ground.
Yeah. So we know that they've been lying through their teeth. And I think one of the amazing, and the story is that, I mean, okay, so it's witnessed by these kids playing football. Was that what they were doing that night?
Yes.
Some kids were playing football. How many kids were there? A few kids then?
There was quite a few kids. When I spoke to Mrs. May trying to figure this out, writing the storyline for the book, at the beginning, TJ, I read countless articles, and I was amazed there was only little bits and pieces about the story, like in a Frank Edwards book or this book or that book. There'd be like a paragraph or a page or something, and every story was different. And I still see it on the internet today. Mrs. May and two kids, Mrs. May and this one, and there was five kids, there was six kids. And I remember talking to Mrs. May one of the first times I spoke to her, and she started laughing. She says, "Frank, the kids were playing football. How are you going to have a football game with two or three kids?"
That's what I was just thinking. I was thinking that. That's why I'm asking that question. There's no way. It's got to be, you know, when we played football, I don't know if you did that as a kid, but we had at least three kids on a team, sometimes more, you know.
The whole town was there. Every kid in the area within miles was playing there. That was Friday night off from school, and that was the thing to do. TJ, I think there was only two television sets in all of Braxton County back then.
Wow. Yeah, so, back in the early 50s.
I was working with Ailey Stewart Jr., the reporter who broke the story. He owned the Braxton Democrat with his dad. And he kept saying, and this was in 1996 when I interviewed him, he said kids didn't have the niceties of kids today, you know, with video games and different stuff and the entertainment and television, cable TV. There was nothing up there. And, you know, a few radios, TJ, they had party lines back then.
Oh, yeah. I remember those things. You remember those?
She knew her telephone number. She remembered her telephone number of a party line. She had a pretty good memory. But anyways, the whole point is, the whole, all the Flatwoods and surrounding areas, every kid was up there playing that night. It wasn't a couple kids.
So it was a whole group. You don't know exactly how many went up there with Mrs. May, because they went to her, right? And then they went up there to investigate.
Right, right. There's a lot more kids, TJ, that went up there that night. Okay. A lot of the kids, when they were playing football and got up to the house, they were actually too scared to go up.
Okay. So that's right. Where you have Mrs. May and her two kids, right? Confirmed.
Right. You have all the other witnesses. But there was a lot of kids. And even of the ones who went up on the hill, there was still some kids, I was told, by one of the other witnesses, he said there was a lot of kids that were way back far away from the crash site area who saw this from a distance. Hmm. But they were too scared to come forward. And I had one witness tell me that intelligence people were walking around telling people in Flatwoods to shut up.
Hmm.
It would be in their best interest if you didn't talk about this.
You know, I wonder, Frank, I never asked you this question, because the Men in Black came around, maybe somewhere in the 60s, I don't know, 50s. Did anybody report anything like that, seeing people with these sunglasses and the fedoras dressed like the Men in Black, like you hear the stories about? Was there any reports?
I had one person tell me that there was a lot of black cars coming in out of Flatwoods. A witness said there was a lot of black cars coming in out of Flatwoods, and nobody had any idea who they were, because there wasn't that many cars in Braxton County back then.
It was a different time
than it was almost 70 years ago. But the one thing that a lot of the witnesses told me about, one in particular who had a keen eye, he actually saw the craft come in that night, Jack Davis. Jack saw the craft go down, and he told me he would see, now it's kind of like you see in the old movies or Mayberry RFD and, right, you know, like that, where the general store was kind of the hub where everybody hung out and gossiped.
Right.
And Jack Davis told me the couple little general stores up there where everybody would hang out on the front porch and gossip and catch up on the fast going news, the state police would come in and they would disperse and break everybody up. And Donald Keough actually brought that up in one of his books. He said he had heard that the state police were involved, and a lot closer into this than you would imagine. So there was a hierarchy working from the bottom all the way up to Washington, as far as agents going up there and state police. The local police were involved at the beginning, but the state police, and there's even a lot of write-ups about state police said this and state police said that in a different newspaper article.
Frank, I would guess there probably was a protocol because of what's happened in the past. They must have developed a protocol that, because they didn't want the public to know. So if you go back to, there was other crashes that took place. There was the one, I think, was it Missouri, right around 1941, there was one there. And there was
the Scoutmaster's case. With the Scoutmaster case took place on August 19th. Where this Verger's claimed when he was out with the Boy Scouts and he went out into the woods that he saw this hideous creature in the turret of a craft. And that was investigated by Project Blue Book. And what is said that because that was so publicly investigated with Blue Book and the press, it stirred a lot of hell up. So now you have Flatwoods. About a month later, we learned our lesson. We're not going to go in here, you know, stirring everything up and making it look like the Air Force was really interested in it. But Mrs. May told me there were guys from Washington who went in and questioned her. And as far as Project Blue Book, I know who the official investigators, field investigators were through my research. And Mrs. May encountered these guys on two different occasions, TJ. The first time was on September 13th, and then, which was a Saturday afternoon, and then she encountered them on the 14th.
And this was obviously, and I know you don't want to go back to it, but anybody that saw the TV show Project Blue Book, nothing at all like that happened. And that Hynek, he wasn't even there investigating this. That we know.
Hynek would have been onto that site because there was crash debris and oil spewing about the place, pieces of silver metal that was melted and black plastic-like substance that was scattered around the farm. People were still picking it up for days and days after. I don't think they would have sent Hynek there.
No.
His job was to cover this up and squash it onto a site where there was crap strewn all over the field. There was too much evidence. Colonel Leavitt was in the night before the intelligence went in there, and they were there on Saturday morning. Colonel Leavitt was actually there sometime after midnight on the 12th going into the 13th with 50 troops, and he told me in his interview he gathered up oil and pieces of this black plastic-like substance that was strewn about the farm. And he went to another crash site, and his troops stayed there overnight. He had about 50 guys up there. And I said, well, how long did they stay for? since you left. He went up, got the sample, set everybody up. They cordoned the area off to civilians, and there were no civilians up there anyways because this happened way the hell out on the back of the Bailey Fisher farm. But he said, my troops stayed overnight. They stayed the night. And I was kind of shocked. I'm like, really? They did? And he said, yes, to see if anything else was going to happen. So he received his orders from the Air Force. They knew this wasn't an owl in a tree. You don't send the National Guard out. There was 180 troops into Braxton County. Levitt went down to the Elk River into the area of Sugar Creek a few miles away where there was a report of an airplane crash. What it actually was another one of these damaged UFOs that had went down. And there were reports going throughout Braxton County. And the sheriff was actually running around like a chicken with his head cut off with the deputy going to these different locations and different sites. And finally, when the guard came into it, they went to this area. Levitt said they had about 180 troops. He set some of them up to look for what was said to be an airplane crash. And then he broke away and went into the Flatwoods area, went up onto the back part of the farm, and they actually came in. I didn't understand this at first until the interview. I was wondering, how the hell did Colonel Levitt get up past the May house? Because that was the access road to the farm. And he would awaken everybody, you know, those trucks would awaken everybody coming, you know, up through that path. And Levitt told me they came in through a back road, which I was shown later on by Freddie May, and we actually walked it. It was a logging path on the north side of the farm, and Levitt parked his trucks around the back side of the farm, and the troops came in up on top so nobody would see them. It was definitely a covert mission. And after everything was gathered up, they stayed up. The troops, there was approximately 50, stayed up there for the night, and then they left. Ailey Stewart Jr., who was the Johnny on the spot, the reporter, he was actually the first one up there in the morning and on the 13th, Saturday morning, and he was there when the sun came up. And he actually is the first person to lay eyes onto the farm where the crash site took place. And that's when he saw all the oil strewn all over the place. He found a piece of metal, and he walked the whole site where the track marks were, where the Flatwoods Monster hovercraft went through the field. And I interviewed him in 1996, and he helped put together the timeline, TJ, of what actually happened that night, because he was the newspaper reporter and he was involved with the local police, the sheriff's department, and the West Virginia State Police. And he actually got the call to go up to the Mays house that night from the West Virginia State Police. And they were out running around the county checking out UFO reports as well as the sheriff. So nobody was around. I mean, there was so much going on that night, so much pandemonium of UFOs flying in over Braxton County. Nobody knew what end was up. So no persons of authority, official authority of police capacity, could get up there. So what happened is Stewart went up there, and he was the first person that went into the Mays house and saw the turmoil with the kids. The kids were sprawled, their faces, and they were covered in oil. They were having problems breathing. They had inhaled this gas. Lemon was throwing up. Gene Lemon, the 18-year-old witness, Mrs. May, was in rough shape, and all the kids, he said, were all talking at once. And once he finally got some type of an organization together, and, you know, everybody was talking at once, it was just like a scene of panic. He said he finally figured out this had happened right in back of the house. Now, the Project Blue Book show showed basically a posse or a mob scene going to the house of Mrs. May and threatening her. Remember that scene?
Yes, sir. I do.
Okay. That didn't happen.
No.
The only scene where there was basically a posse, I don't know if you want to call it a mob, but it was a big posse armed with guns and rifles and shotguns and handguns, is when Stewart went up to the crash site where the monster was seen, and he went with Mrs. May's father and some of the locals. They all went up there armed. And he got a couple of the kids to go up there, and he said one of the boys was so nervous and freaked out and scared, he had to grab him by the scruff of the neck, and he was actually crying like a whipped pup. They wanted to know where this happened, and nobody wanted to go up there, which I couldn't blame them. I wouldn't want to go back there after seeing that thing. But eventually they went up there onto the site, and he said he called them electric lanterns. They were electric flashlights, but that's what he called them, were electric lanterns. And they spotted around the area. And from his Air Force background and warfare, he knew from chemicals and sprays, the kids kept talking about the gases, which made them sick and choking. They couldn't breathe right. So he had kneeled down on the ground because he knew gas settled. And he picked up that aroma in the grass and through the dirt where this Flatwoods monster was seen near the tree. So he said they spotlighted around for a little while, and I said, how long were you up there for? And he basically said we weren't up there that long because we were not inclined to hunt for something in the dark. We didn't know what it was. Now, these kids are describing something that's 10 to 12 feet tall. They're hysterical, and those guys had to have a lot of, you know what I'm going to say.
I know exactly what you're going to say.
First place, looking for a 12-foot-tall monster.
Yeah, I know. But they never saw anything when they went up there because it already had taken off, right?
It had taken off. What it did, TJ, is when this thing landed, it landed on the back part of the Bailey Fisher property, which was a cleared area, approximately the size of a football field. For your listeners, you get an idea. It was like a bald spot on the top of a mountain. Years ago, Jack Davis really drove this point home. Myself and another friend, we picked Jack Davis up, and he directed us to another part of Flatwoods, to another area. We drove up this long-ass, windy road, TJ, and we ended up at the top, and he says, pull over here. Now, Jack Davis knew the area. He grew up there, and he lived there for years. We jumped over a barrier, and we went out to private property, and I'm like, are we going to get shot here, Jack? And he's like, nah, I know the guy. And we're walking through this field, and we stopped, and we looked directly out across, and you could see Flatwoods from the air, from a high elevation where we were. TJ, it was kind of cool. And Jack says, now look out there in that direction, boys. He says, where do you see a clearing? And we scanned the sky from left to right. And TJ, I didn't know where we were, because when you're going up these windy roads, you don't know which way you're facing anymore. But once I got my bearings and I was looking, he says, look out over there. Where do you see a clearing? And I point. I said, it's obvious. It's a bald spot on the top of the mountain. He said, that's where the Flatwoods monster craft touched down. So when you're coming out of the sky, that thing made a clean landing on that bald part of the mountain. And I'm really glad I saw that. So then we went back down, and we went back up on, Jack took us up onto the location, and we saw it firsthand. What this thing did is it touched down out of the sky, and because it was at a high point, it relocated where it couldn't be readily seen, because the thing was glowing and it was pulsing. And it landed in the gully of the farm set by some pear trees way off to the back corner of the farm. When this Flatwoods monster, which was actually a hovercraft machine, when it departed its craft, it was hovering. It had some type of a propulsion system. Now, picture grass 3 to 4 feet high and walking through with a leaf blower that's 4 feet wide. That's what this thing actually did, is it cut a path from the craft where it went down and where it relocated and went down into the gully. And then it came across the field, went up an incline, went across the dirt path, and it hid up behind a tree. And that's where it was seen a little while later. Now, while it was in that tree area, basically resting, it was hiding. This tree was set about 3 or 4 feet off the path to the left of the path. When the witnesses were coming up, Mrs. May and the boys, and there was a dog that came up and ran ahead, went into the mist. This Flatwoods Monster machine was spewing off, and this is what made the kids sick and everybody sick. It was like a sulfur smell. It was a gas from its propulsion system. And Mrs. May and Gene Lemon were leading the pack, and they saw something up in the tree. It was about 10 feet in the air, and they didn't know it. It looked, they were big eyes. They thought it was a raccoon or something. That's what Lemon thought. That's what he's documented as saying. And they flashed their flashlights into that area, and because this thing was tucked back off the path and it was starting to get dark, it was in the shadow of the woods. When they hit their flashlight on it, Mrs. May told me it lit up like a Christmas tree. So I wanted to know if this thing had reacted to her flashlight beam, and she said definitely it did. It reacted to me and Lemon's flashlights. This thing lifted off the ground, and it was spewing oil out, and it was splattered all over the area. Colonel Levitt told me when he was up there that night and they went into the tree area, there was actually a big puddle of this blackish oil that was sitting by the tree. And I asked, what did you do with it? He says, I collected it all up. They put it in bottles and cans, boxed everything up, and they shipped it off to Washington. So he cleaned evidence out that night. And I asked him, was there anything burned? And he kind of like snapped back at me, no, nothing was burned. And when you see the way that the Flatwoods show is portrayed in Project Blue Book, it looked like a 747 plugged that field, and it was on fire, and absolutely false.
Yeah.
There was no fire whatsoever. Whatever had landed there had cooled down, whatever type of propulsion system it was, God only knows. There was no burn spots, and Levitt was up there that night, and he hit all the areas.
How did you ever get Levitt to tell you all this stuff?
Why wasn't easy.
Why did he come clean on all this? Was, you think, his conscience, or he wanted the truth to get out? Or why would a colonel, and normally they're sworn to secrecy, why was this man speaking?
Well, the first time I spoke to Levitt, we went up to the farm, TJ, and he would not let me tape him. I was actually with my mom. We were on a trip, and he took both of us up there onto the field. No recording devices were allowed, and he started telling me, and I knew about his involvement of the West Virginia National Guard, because the people knew up there, and it had been documented how Colonel Levitt and his troops were up there for days and weeks for crowd control. Because when this hit the news wires, there were people coming from all over the world to go to Flatwoods. So Levitt was up there for crowd control. Then the first time I talked to him, TJ, I almost fell over when he started going into details of what had actually happened, how he was up there with troops. And he was up there on a covert mission gathering samples, and he went on and on and on. I was in absolute shock because he never talked about this before. He knew I had a drive to get to the bottom of this thing, TJ, and I was relentless. And I've said this a couple times, probably on your show before. It got to the point where I was such a pain in the ass with Levitt. I was writing him, calling him, showing up at his front door. If he wasn't there, I'd be talking with his wife and wait until he came home. And it probably got to the point where he was either going to shoot me or talk to me. And this went on for a long time. I was calling his house, leaving messages, on and on and on. And finally, I went to his house and I called him up. I said I was in town from, for a couple days. Can I come in and talk to you? And I remember we were standing in the driveway in front of his house, and I just laid it out on him. And, that you could change history. And in so many words, you know, I'm not going to go into, but it was like a man-to-man, one-on-one talk. If he didn't come clean with this, the people involved in this case were going to look like goddamn fools and idiots. And these people and the natives of that area we're going to be known as assholes in the history books. And I said, and there's one person you could change that could change this, Dale. I said, it's going to be you. I said, so please think about it. Do you want your people going down in the history book looking like freaking assholes and jokes in front of the world? And, you know, that's that was nice compared to what I really said to him, TJ. Yeah, I got fired up with my Italian.
I bet you did, Frank. How tall are you, Frank? What are you, 6 foot, what, four?
Yeah, 6'4", 250.
Yeah, so you're kind of an, and then the Italian part of you comes out. I think that's a little intimidating, even for a former colonel to be around.
Yeah. And I was nervous being around Leavitt at first, believe me, because I heard stories about Leavitt in the war. And Leavitt was actually the sheriff of Braxton County in the 1960s. He's a war hero. I'm going to show him respect, but it got to the point, that was basically my Hail Mary. And this was after, because he opened his mouth up and he started telling me details when I was up there the first time with Mom. And he spoke to me on the farm for about 45 minutes. And my jaw hit the ground. And after that, it's like, oh, he opened his mouth up. This is great. I can write this down. And at that point, I wasn't planning on writing a book. This was just kind of something, you know, I was putting together. And if it turned into something, and I was going to school back then, and film school, and, you know, whatever was going to happen, I had no idea it was going to come this far. But eventually, when I spoke to Mrs. May, and I started getting further involved into this project, and I started piecing it together, and Leavitt was the balls of my story. And I asked him more questions during the second interview. And TJ, it's kind of cool. After the second interview, where I was allowed to tape them, to tape him on the farm, there was stuff that he told me I had no flipping idea what the hell he was talking about. No idea. And I transcribed his interview, and I had all of these notes. And the first thing I did is I made multiple copies of Colonel Leavitt's interview and shipped them out all over the world to people I know. I didn't want to be the holder of this unbelievable interview. So what happened is, as I started researching further and talking to other witnesses and reading newspaper articles and getting involved in the Blue Book documents, everything started piecing together. And then I understood what Dale Leavitt was talking about. I said, wow, this is what he was talking about here and there. And this was years later, TJ. So he told me stuff I had no idea at that time, but eventually I figured out what it was. And for years, I was pulling out, I had an old VHS copy. I wore that thing to death, and I kept watching it, playing it in slow motion, going through my notes, my transcriptions of what I've written down. And finally, I was able to figure out the majority of what the hell he was talking about. But back when during that first taped interview, I didn't know what he was saying. It didn't make sense to me.
Right. How would you? And then when did you have the big aha moment? Because when you first started following this, you were taking basically these eyewitness accounts. That's where you kind of started, right? But people told you, and when did you have this moment? Was there ever any doubt when you talked to these people, when you first started looking into this? Because you had never heard of this before, right?
No. I stumbled onto this because I have family and went up there on a trip and went to a town that said, welcome to Flatwoods, home of the Green Monster.
And did you, when you first saw that, did you believe that to be true, or were you going, yeah, right?
I had no idea what it was. Until I talked to a couple people in, you know, the local restaurant and eateries, and they filled me in on it, and they were selling Braxton County Monster statues up there. They were little lanterns that the JCs put together in, I think it was the mid-60s. And then when I got back home, I started researching this, and that's what I said earlier, TJ. There was 100 different accounts and 100 different books of the Flatwoods Monster, and every single, even if it was a paragraph or a page, every single account was different. And it was just too screwy of a story. Then I started going through, going up to the libraries, and I went to Charleston Libraries, the Clarksburg Library, where the Gray Barker Archives was held. And he researched the Flatwoods Monster back in the day. And I was just hitting different libraries all over. Then I started doing radio shows way later, and people would hear me talking and says, wow, you know, let me go look at my local newspaper. Because, TJ, you're talking a big square mile area of 10 East Coast states up and down the eastern seaboard. So you're talking a lot of coverage, and people started sending me these little articles from podunk towns.
So you started piecing it all together, and then, but right away, you were kind of convinced that this could be true. You were open to the possibility.
Hey, not right off the bat. I didn't know what to think, because reading those stupid little excerpts in different parts in those, you know, like those little Frank Edwards books and mysterious books and, you know, the little paperbacks.
Right.
That's all I found. Then I found some of Kehoe's works where Kehoe had investigated this. And then the more I looked into it, then I got hold of Stanton Friedman, and Stanton got me on the right track. And I just kept pushing and pushing and pushing and traveling and traveling. Went through a lot of tires. And a lot of chocolate milk and peanut butter crackers, which back in the early days, that's where me and my guys were living on, being on the road, because everything was devoted to gas, batteries, camera equipment.
This you did this all on the side while you probably held down a full-time job. We never talked about that, but were you also working somewhere and you kind of did this on your spare time?
This became my way of life. And when I was in film school, and I was starting to put some of this stuff together, and I learned editing, and I was working with a fellow who now works in Hollywood. He's a Steadicam operator. He was a teacher of mine at film school. And he really took me under his wing because he knew I had something good, but it was in developmental stages. I didn't know what I was going to do with this project. It was just going to be like a little documentary thing, TJ. I never thought it was going to go into a book. And it's like every time I went back to West Virginia, what happened is the people were starting to talk about, oh, there's this guy coming up here from Florida who's really hardcore into this Flatwoods case. Maybe you should talk to him. So before you know it, TJ, the people that were slamming doors in my face are inviting me to their homes. In the meantime, I had pulled out the Project Blue Book documents and started deciphering them, re-inking them, putting everything into an order. And I was going up to Flatwoods and showing this information to Kathleen May. I showed it to Freddie May. I was talking to some of the other people involved with the case, and they had no idea how heavily documented this was by the government. So before you know it, Frank, go talk to this one, go talk to this one, and everybody's helping me out now. The people who basically shunned me, now everybody's working with me. And in the meantime, I met a fella, and he became a money backer of mine. So I've been doing this on somebody else's dime for all of these years.
That's a pretty good gig.
Yeah, we are very good friends. Basically, he's my money supplier. He trusts me. He knows I'm no nonsense. I don't take shit. And I only work with the best, TJ. I work with the best. I don't play games. And if somebody, and this happened a lot in the early days of film school, I'd get the younger kids wanting to work. If they were goofballs or idiots, bang, they got thrown out of the group, out of the circle. Just don't turn back, because now I have a money investor in this project, and I'm not going to take anything from anybody. There's too much on the line.
Why did this person invest in this? But did he have a curiosity? Why was this person supportive of you?
We had a couple talks, you know, while I was in film school, and he was just blown away with this whole thing. And he wasn't really into flying saucers. He saw my drive and determination. And I have a hell of a background in the arts field, illustration, painting. I was trained in the Renaissance-style painting, calligraphy. You know, I learned everything across the board from the old masters at Pear Art School. Then I came down here, and I hooked up with the camera teacher who's in Hollywood now. And I worked with him, and I worked. Now, TJ, back at this point in the early 90s, when I went back to college, I was the same age as my teachers. I wasn't fresh out of school, a teenager. I was about the same age as the teachers.
So that's how you were able to pursue this more doggedly than probably other people who could have just would have done this, you know, when they had free moments. You were able to dive into this.
I could have done it. And in the early days, I was using film equipment from the college. I was back then in the early 90s, the Hi-8 was the camera to be. And I was using field cameras that were $50,000, $60,000, and they were letting me take them out of the state. But, you know, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
Right.
I had to work with the health and nursing department, and with my extensive background in art, I had to do medical drawings for the medical department, illustrations of the body, you know, cutaways of the different parts of the heart, the brain, the eyes, the whole human body, muscles, skeletal system. And I sat down and I worked with one of the top teachers who was a big nurse at Halifax Hospital. And they said, well, Frank, we'll let you take the camera equipment out whenever you want, but we got a little favor. And there it is, just like the mafia. Hey, a little favor, TJ. And my little favor is I had to do medical illustrations for the Phillips Junior College. It was part of my curriculum. They gave me credits for it. But I had to take the nursing department. So that was kind of tough, too. I was the only guy in there with, like, 30 nurses.
Yeah, that must have been tough, Frank. You poor guy.
That was really tough.
I feel so bad for you. So, you know, we're already at an hour, and I don't know where you want to go, how much further you want to go, but we kind of laid the base down of what really happened. And there was many more things, witnesses after that that see that, saw this event. But the big issue, I think, is that there was this craft that landed. It was witnessed by many people in that area. And you talked to pretty much all of them, didn't you?
The majority of them. Some of them I couldn't get hold of. Some had passed away. But I talked to everybody I can get my hands on. I spoke to the key player.
Right.
I spoke to Colonel Levitt. And I also spoke to Mrs. May, the primary witness.
And how was Mrs. May towards you the first time you met her? How did she treat you?
Mrs. May?
Yeah, the first time you met her.
She was a really sweet lady.
So, because she had been given the runaround by other people before, so you said these people were leery to talk to outsiders, but you're saying even then she was still nice to you.
Yes, she was. But she didn't unload and give me all the information. And it kind of, with everybody up there, TJ, they did not work and talk to me until I proved myself to them. Because they were tired for, at that point, over 50 years of the reporters going in looking for their silly-ass stories around Halloween time.
Right.
They got disgusted with it. But now here I come in with Project Blue Book documents. I started gathering up. I'm sitting here surrounded with notebooks filled with Flatwoods Monster, Associated Press, United Press articles. I have probably every, even from foreign countries in different languages, every newspaper article on earth ever printed about Flatwoods. In the meantime, I'm going up and I'm showing the witnesses all of this stuff. And they knew I was serious. They knew I was in film school. And then that's when I started documenting them and talking a little bit more with Mrs. May. And it was like every time I went back, I had more information for them. I kept showing them. So they trusted me. And that's the key word is trust.
Yeah.
And they knew I was no nonsense. And I told them I would get this out. And one thing Kathleen May was would always say to me, she says, Frank, I hope you get your book out before I pass away. She says, you worked hard on this thing, and which I did. And I was very upfront and truthful with all the people. I was working with a small little community, TJ. I wasn't working with the guys in Brooklyn. I was not used to this. And they were all kind, great people. They worked with me. And then as I got further on, I discovered the reason that they shunned everybody off and blew them away is because the world made them look like idiots. They made them look like fools at night. And it's hard to believe, even today, it's still talked about as a folklore. It's like, read my book. Go on my website. Look at the pictures. The only way anybody is going to persuade me from my belief, if they could explain my master map of what happened with 116 plotted locations and why these things were flying damaged all over the place and there were reptilians seen. It's an unreal story, TJ. And the further I got into it, I kind of understood in 52 why they covered it up. When you have 9-10 foot tall aliens that are snake reptilians roaming around Earth that we shot down out of the sky.
Pretty fascinating stuff. And it's funny how it took you quite a while, but it all came together as if it was meant to be, as if this was part of your purpose for being here. And
you know, TJ, you know who said that to me? The last time I saw her was Kathleen May.
Yeah, interesting.
Remember her sitting in her easy chair, and I was sitting in a chair across from her, and she turned around and looked at me, and she said, Frank, God put you on this earth to solve this. To solve this case. She says, that's why you're here. She says, you're never going to convince me otherwise. And she even called me your third son because I spent much time with her. And me not having a granny, she was like my granny. And I really went out and above to tell this story and get it right. I was just tired of the inaccuracies. And TJ, there are so many people today who are claiming they're the Flatwoods Monster expert. They're this and they're that. And it's like, when you've been there and dedicated more than half of your life, like I did, then you could talk to me. Otherwise, just sit in the background.
You know,
this is my story. I've been working on it every day of my life since 1991. And thank God for my sponsor, Rob, because he's the one that made this all possible. He just lets me go and just whatever I want to do, I do. If I need a consultation, if I need something, we talk. I have a little crew of guys that I work with. Dr. Phil is a very good friend, and I work with Phil sometimes. Sometimes you go, you know, just in a personal life, you go into a different direction, you get confused. TJ, I have turned down 15 documentaries in 3 years. 15. Small little putz documentaries from all the way up to BBC and Japanese broadcasting channels. I just do not want to get involved with them anymore because you lose creative control and they're going to do something stupid.
Yeah.
If you want to read the truth, listen to one of my interviews with you or read my book.
If they came to you with a contract and said, you're going to run it whatever way you want, we will not change it. We'll sign here. We'll give you a lot of money. Would you think about doing it then?
I may, but they don't offer anything, TJ. You work your ass off, and you don't get paid enough.
Just like being on this show.
Yeah, you know, but once you lose creative control, that's it. And you lose creative control.
Yeah,
I was working with a couple of kids once on a show, and I looked at them. They said something. I said, this T-shirt I'm wearing is older than you. I forgot more shit than you'll ever know. But they'll tell me what, you know, what's what. And they just kind of looked at me. It's like, okay.
We don't want to get the big Italian upset, is what they were thinking.
Not me. It's some of the people in back of me who are in my group. You don't want to upset them either.
So... But I think it's an amazing story, and the first time I came across it, like I said, I didn't Not that I was closed off to it, because I'm open to everything. But I thought, well, if this is true, how come I didn't hear about it? I think that's what some of us probably. And then as you know, like anything out there, Frank, if you just take the time, if people that are listening right now, if you haven't explored Frank's website, go there right now if you want and take a look at it. There's so much documentation. And then the books have even more. It's hours and hours of his life. And also I wanted to say, Frank, that we all wonder what our purpose is in life, maybe at different times, or maybe the thought never crosses some people's mind, but it's kind of nice to know, you know, this is not your sole purpose, but kind of nice to know in a way, this is why you were here. This is part of the reason why you came to this and living in this lifetime is that.
Me. A lot of people have said that, including Kathleen, the last time I saw her, and I kind of took that to heart. It's like, well, maybe right. This is the reason. There's no coincidences.
Right.
I know many times I wish I had a dollar for every time I heard that one, including from Dr. Phil. And if Frank, it's meant to be, this is the way it's going to be, and you know, so on and so forth. There are no coincidences. And the further I get into this, I see that he's absolutely true.
Yeah, it's a cool thing, and it's, you know what, it's going to come forward someday. I think there's more going to happen here, Frank, and I'm certainly here to support you any way I can. So is there anything else you want to tell us before we wrap up?
No, I think we got pretty much. We can probably do a couple more shows in the near future.
Sure, anytime you want, we can talk more in detail. I don't know what you want to talk about. You and I talk about things off the air. We send emails back and forth, so I don't know to where you want to go, how far you want to go with it, any of it, but...
Well, something soon.
Okay, sounds good.
Another joint show with Dr. Phil.
That sounds like a plan. We could certainly do that again.
All right, TJ.
Well, thank you, Frank.
All right, and thank you, and we'll talk to you soon.